Hey, 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 Soul Tribe. Welcome back. This is episode 2.4 of Beyond Deconstructing Neurodivergence. I'm your host, T. Jamaica Polk, affectionately known as Deconstructing Neuro. And today's episode is brought to you by the Neuro Spicy Bodega. Step into a world where fashion meets neurodiversity, where your uniqueness is celebrated with style and flair. Welcome to the Neural Spicy Bodega, where we're all about embracing your neural spicy identity in the most fashionable way possible. Picture this, the Spicy Spectrum Collection, a burst of colors celebrating the beautiful diversity of the neurodivergent experience. Or how about the Monospice Collection, where minimalist elegance makes a bold and serene statement. And don't miss the iconic Bodega Collection, a heartfelt homage to the haven that is noise-canceling headphones for those of us with sensory sensitivities. Whether you're on the spectrum, embracing minimalism, or seeking solace in sensory protection, the Neural Spicy Bodega has something for everyone. Join us in celebrating the multifaceted nature of neurodiversity. Wear your story with pride and make a statement that's uniquely you. As a special thank you for being part of the Beyond Deconstructing family, enjoy $10 off your first order of $50 or more using promo code BEYOND. And don't forget to sign up for the Neural Spicy Bodega mailing list to be the first to know about new releases and promotions. Visit theneuralspicybodega.com today and let your style speak volumes about your incredible neurospicy identity. Welcome back. Welcome back. So for those of you who follow me regularly, you may have noticed that last week there was no new episode, and that's because I had to move out of my apartment. So just a quick recap. Back in February of this year, after I finished traveling, I came home and the plan was to live with a friend and work this work from home job and save up money so that I can eventually become a full-time content creator. And that quickly went sideways. I had to find my own place within a few days of living with this person because I found out, or I realized, that they weren't who I thought they were and they weren't actually a friend. And because of that, I was in a pinch and I just got the first apartment that I was able to get that wasn't completely run down, but it also wasn't something that I had enough time to really look into and evaluate how good it was. So shortly after moving in, I started having issues with mice getting into my apartment. It took 3 different maintenance requests for them to come in and actually do something about it. And in the process, I realized that I'm allergic to mice. So once that issue was finally resolved, then there were still issues with the air conditioner leaking and then water coming up through my floor, that never being addressed. And then the straw that broke the camel's back was a pipe burst within the wall behind the cabinet that was located over my sink. And I didn't know this because it was a slow leak to the point that the wood at the back of the cabinet started to rot and mold got into my apartment. But I didn't notice it until it got so bad that it was coming out the bottom of the cabinet. I'm short. I'm 5'3" on a good day. So I had no idea what was happening at the top of the cabinet until it basically rotted through to the bottom where I was eye level with it. And then even then it took maintenance forever to come in and take that out, to the point that they took the whole cabinet out, left a hole in my drywall for weeks. And by the time I moved out, they still hadn't replaced the cabinet. There was a space missing or a big open space over my sink for like the last month and a half that I was living there. So I just was completely over this place. The place was literally making me sick. I had breathing issues. I had to buy an air purifier due to the mouse dander, the mold, the old fucking no ventilation in the building. The management is trash. The maintenance is just lackadaisical. And I had to get the fuck out of there. And it coincided with me quitting my job. And so I really only needed that apartment because of the job. It was a work from home job, but it wasn't like I could move around because it required a lot of desk equipment. So I needed the apartment because I needed a home base in order to work my job, and I needed that job in order to keep the apartment. But I didn't like either. I actually hated both. So once I decided that I wanted to get out of that apartment, I also realized that it would be the perfect opportunity to also quit that job. So I am currently crashing at my mom's house. But you know what? I actually, over the last few days, it's only been almost a week now, I feel so much better. Firstly, my breathing has improved. I have not had sinus issues like I was having. Like, I kept getting these sinus infections and these sinus headaches, even though I worked from home, so I knew I wasn't getting sick from other people. I lived by myself. There was no one else fucking there. It was the apartment itself making me sick. So in the last, 6 days of being out of there, I feel so much better. I feel less stressed. And also now I get to actually devote my time to the things that I love, which is my content creation, which is doing this for you guys, which is producing this podcast and bringing conversations to the forefront that really need to happen within the autistic community. And then on top of that, you guys, if you remember in the season premiere, I announced that I'm writing a book called The Neural Spicy Dictionary. I haven't been able to get much work done on that in the last 6 weeks, simply because I was battling everything with working a full-time job and trying to balance that with the stress of my environment and also trying to find time to take care of myself. And so now that I no longer have to deal with the stress of that apartment and I no longer have to deal with the stress of that job, I can actually devote the time that I've always wanted to bringing you guys the content that I believe is truly important for us to share. And with that being said, today's guest, I'm super excited to get into the interview, which we will in a moment. But this person, we're actually mutuals on TikTok, and I first stumbled upon their content when I was really deep in my bag of deconstructing like corporate hierarchy and corporate structures and what it's like to be neurodivergent, being autistic in particular, and being an autistic woman in the workplace. And a lot of her perspective is informed by being a person in leadership in this kind of structure, but also being an autistic woman. And I think that she has so much great insight to share. And I'm super excited to get into it. So actually, I'm going to do things a little bit out of order. I'm going to go into the interview section now and then afterwards come back for a little bit of TikTok therapy. Today, I'm thrilled to introduce to you an exceptional trailblazer who is helping to reshape the narrative around autism and advocating for authentic representation within the media. Rachel Lowenstein, the global head of inclusive innovation at Mindshare, has made it her mission to amplify the voices of autistic creators and provide them with the platform they deserve. Rachel's journey begins with a deep and personal understanding of the misconceptions that surround autism. She has firsthand experience with the frustrating and often ignorant comments that so many autistic individuals encounter. And recognizing the urgent need for change, Rachel embarked on a transformative endeavor that we're excited to learn more about today. In collaboration with Getty Images and Hickey, she spearheaded the hashtag Autistic Out Loud Self-Portraiture Project unveiled at Cannes Lions 2023. So today I'm honored to have Rachel on Beyond Deconstructing, and together we're going to delve into the power of self-representation, the transformation of the media's portrayal of autism, and the pressing need for authentic voices in advocacy. Thank you, Rachel, so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm super excited to learn more about your project that I introduced in the intro. But before we even dive into that, I would love for you to share with my audience your personal journey with understanding your neurodivergence and how that impacts you today.
Yeah, I'd be happy to share. I think my story is actually quite similar to a lot of other autistic women, femme and non-binary folks, where I discovered I was autistic during quarantine and during the pandemic. So I had struggled with anxiety and depression my entire adult life. Like many folks, I like quite literally could not remember what it meant to not be depressed or anxious, except for when I was a child. And when we were told to stay home, not socialize, be far less stimulated in March of 2020, although I was scared with what was happening in the world, for the first time in my adult life, I felt kind of at peace, which felt really weird during a really scary time in the world. Mm-hmm. And obviously that was quite a privilege to be able to stay home and when so many people couldn't, but it gave me so much clarity that maybe everything that I'd been struggling with, I had been asking the wrong questions about, and I had been thinking about incorrectly. And at that moment, I didn't have an answer. But what started to happen as I started to see autistic women and non-binary folks on my For You page on TikTok. And slowly, I started to think, wow, I really relate to the things that they're saying. Like, head nodding, because so many people have experience. And it was only through autistic voices that I was able to start to see myself in a way that I had never been understood. So that was around, at this point, maybe like April or May. And I have been doing a little bit of research on my side and just spent a few months kind of sitting with it. And unfortunately, because of the ableist tones that have existed in media, I almost didn't want to tell anybody because I thought it was something that people wouldn't believe or that it was something to be ashamed about, which of course it isn't. But I internalized that until the summer when I told my fiance, Matt, hey, I'm kind of thinking about this and I don't really know what to make of it, but I think I want to pursue a diagnosis. And I'm so grateful that he was so supportive of it and immediately said, what can I do to support that and help you? So flash forward a few months and I was extremely privileged to be able to get a assessment from a psychiatrist and got my diagnosis that day. And the diagnostic appointment ended with, and I'll never forget this, the doctor saying, I'm so sorry, you should have been diagnosed as a child.
Wow.
And, you know, it was a little bit of grief for a while to think about all of the years that I had maybe wasted misdirecting my energy towards trying to fix a solution that in some cases isn't fixable, but also I was using the wrong tools to try to fix an issue that, you know, I needed to be fixed with different tools and finding better ways to support myself and celebrate my autistic identity. And then within, you know, those months of grieving, I found a lot of peace and opportunity to really think about what I wanted to do in the future. And as somebody who works in media, I immediately began to feel very passionate and strong about the way that autism is represented in media. And that's led me into a path that I never thought would be possible, but I'm very grateful we were able to do some of the work that we've done over the last few months.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your journey. I always love to hear the unique perspectives, but it's also lovely to see kind of like the through points or the things that connect us all. And I've had the privilege through this platform of being able to speak to dozens of other autistic people so far and hear their journeys. And a lot of what you said resonates, but then it also is unique to your experience that we're going to get to shortly related to your role in the media. But one thing I wanted to talk on is you brought up that you saw women and non-binary people on TikTok, and that's what helped it click for you. How important do you think like intersectionality is when it comes to our representation in the media? Because so far, if we're represented, it's usually a male, usually a white male. So I just kind of wanted to get your perspective on that really quickly since you brought that up.
It's not representation if it's not intersectional, right? Like if you just have a monolithic representation of like, okay, we checked a box, we have a woman, but it's a white woman, or okay, we checked a box, but it's, we have one black person and no other, you know, people who are black from different backgrounds. You have to think about people's nuanced experiences because no group is monolithic and everyone is going to experience their identity in very different ways. And the intersectionality is what makes our stories so unique and so important. You know, I think the reality is that autistic spaces have been dominated, you know, by male voices for a very long time. And now we're starting to see, you know, white women voices. And I'm certainly a part of that. We all experience autism in ways that connect us. And we also experience it in ways that are very distinct based off of those unique identities. So I think we could probably have a bigger conversation. We talk about the Autistic Out Loud project, but all that to being said, you know, it's, if you aren't folks centering or including in a meaningful way people who are from different backgrounds than the norm, then your representation isn't going to go very far and it might actually be doing more harm than it is doing good.
Completely agree. And that's actually a great segue because, you know, can you share the inspiration behind the Autistic Out Loud project or give us a little bit more information about what it is and then the inspiration behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Autistic Out Loud is a project that we did as an agency. So Mindshare is a media agency within WPP. WPP is an advertising conglomerate. And Hiki. And Hiki is one of our pro bono clients that we work with. So the project was a self-portraiture project where we had autistic creators from different backgrounds taking self-portraits of themselves to represent their experience as an autistic individual from their perspective, from their lived experiences. And all of those images are available on a commercial image bank on Getty Images, meaning brands, media companies, anybody can license those images and use them in their media, use them in their advertising, use them in their content. And Getty Images is a platform that has done a ton of really good work in representation and evolving representation for people with disabilities, for other identity groups. But I think, as we both know, autism is one of those areas that is very unfortunately and very loudly overlooked in the media industry. So the inspiration behind it was really born out of me, as somebody who's a leader in the media industry, seeing in autistic spaces the frustration that we all collectively have about how autism is misrepresented, right? The puzzle piece. Usually just white children, mostly young white boys, usually centering parents' voices. And although, you know, parents do have a role in a conversation when as it relates to advocating in partnership with their kids, they can't be the central voice in autistic spaces. Yeah. You know, I think we can go on and on about the ways that autism has been misrepresented. We see those issues. Our community has been talking about it. And then on the other side, being on the media in the media industry, working with big Fortune 500 brands, working with big media companies, this was an issue that I saw and I thought, that's really fixable. That is something that in the next 10 years, we could flip the narrative entirely. And 10 years is maybe even a very long time to say that. So seeing that issue and then knowing what a, you know, frankly, privileged position I'm in to be able to work with people like Getty Images, work with major brands who could feature this content in their advertising. I almost took this as a challenge of like, challenge accepted. Let's try and start to make steps to fix this issue. So we have been working with Hiki, which is an autistic relationship app to help connect autistic folks to friendships, to relationships, and to community. They're essentially like Bumble, but for the autistic community. Went to Jamil, who's the founder and a wonderful, wonderful human and advocate for the autistic community. And I said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And he was like, hell yeah. Getty Images from the get-go was like, absolutely, we have to fix this issue. We see it and we acknowledge it. And they had been doing work with the NDLA, which is the National Disability, I'm going to get it wrong, the NDLA, they're a disability advocacy organization. Mm-hmm. They work with ASIN and other autistic advocacy groups. So we went to Getty, we constructed the project, we identified the creators that we wanted to work with, and then we launched it at Cannes. And Cannes is it's the largest advertising event in the world. So all of the big advertisers, all the big platforms like TikTok, Meta, X, Twitter, whatever the hell they're called now, they're all won't even get into that. So they're all there. And that was a really intentional move on our part because we knew that by launching at a place where brands and media organizations were, we could get the attention of other brands, of other media organizations to join this effort with us. Very proud to say that Google, as part of some work that we did with the New Project, is Google's effort to make events more neuro-inclusive. Google pledged to use the assets as part of the New Project. So that's live right now. So shout out to Google. They are a wonderful partner. And then we also had another brand who is pledging to use the assets that we're undertaking right now. I think the biggest challenge in this entire project is how do we just continue to do more of this? How do we get other brands to pledge to use the content? Mm-hmm. So hopefully more to come there, but I'm quite proud of the work. I think the creators who participated were just, you know, so creative and represent such a broad visual of what it means to be autistic and brought their own voices to it. So I'm very grateful and very humbled that they could participate in this work.
That's awesome. I love to hear that, especially hearing that Google is basically like so omnipresent, like anyone who gets on the internet, you know, they stumble upon Google. So to know that they have partnered with you guys and that they're going to be using these images as well, makes me really excited. Like, I know you probably saw me over here, like, nodding my head. I'm like, registering all of it. I'm like, this is awesome. I love hearing this. Because again, to just kind of bouncing off what you said, it's very, are the images that are traditionally out there are very one-sided and they don't show the full spectrum of people on the spectrum. So I love this. And actually, I would love if you could tell us more about the self-portraiture project itself, because I like the fact that you guys were commissioning or asking for people to represent themselves in this. Like, it's great to call people in, but as you mentioned, a lot of our representation is from an outside view. And so if you can let us know a little bit more about the self-portraiture project itself and how it aims to challenge the existing narrative around autism.
Yeah, I'm so glad you wanted to drill into that, because that was such a central part to the project. You know, when we were first concepting it, there was a lot of conversations amongst all the parties involved of how do we want to approach this from a creative lens, right? If you go on Getty Images, almost all of the content on there is shot by a photographer, right? So a commercial photographer who licensed the images. And that would certainly have been, I think, a viable route. But to me, what was most important is we were spotlighting the fact that autistic folks have been spoken over, spoken for, and not represented from our perspectives. So what we saw between myself, between Hiki, between Getty Images was this clear kind of missing point, which is that we've been misrepresented. Why can't we just represent ourselves? And that's really why we advocated and pushed for the self-portraiture lens. And Getty Images was so supportive of that because, you know, their core mission is one, making images commercially viable. So making sure the images could be licensed, but two is having a creative platform that represents people from an intersectional lens, from a very nuanced lens. And they understood the importance of self-portraiture very early. Once we went through what we wanted to do in the project, they very clearly were like, oh yeah, self-portraiture is a perfect angle to go here. Although it was honestly quite distinct from what you typically see on a commercial image bank platform.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. I saw a few of the images myself and I was just like, oh, it made me so happy. I was like, I actually wish that I had one up now. I know I saved them somewhere, but I'm not going to waste time looking for it right now. But I just remember feeling this overwhelming sense of, like, it hit me in my gut. Like, this makes me so happy.
Oh, you're literally going to make me cry, because my only goal in this project was for autistic folks to feel seen. Like, forget all the commercial aspect, forget like all of that. I just wanted autistic people to see these images and think, that's me, or I see myself in that person, or I've never seen somebody who's autistic who was represented this way. So that means the world to me. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for doing this. And I actually wanted to drill a little bit even more into it, because I know that there was a recent article that you wrote mentioning harmful stereotypes surrounding autism in the media, and this project itself is challenging those stereotypes. In your article, you did also mention that the challenging stereotypes is not the only thing, but economic opportunities are also being presented out of this project. So could you share a little bit more about how that is accomplished and also why that's important, especially regarding autistic people and economic opportunities?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I think, you know, as we both know, autistic folks are extremely at risk to be under or unemployed. I believe the latest stats are somewhere around 80% of us are under or unemployed. And, you know, that could be a whole other conversation on why that happens. This project, if we're being honest, isn't the be-all, end-all solution to economic empowerment for autistic folks. But I think, I mean, what you do exactly with your podcast, what you do with your platform, what I do in social media is a way for autistic folks to work in a way that is accessible to them, right?
Yeah.
And the way that that is going to be economically viable for autistic folks, as somebody who works in media, is by brands partnering with autistic people, right? Work with them in brand partnerships. Like, forget about, you know, disability focused campaigns. Just put autistic people in your normal campaigns. Hire them. Hire us. Mm-hmm. So this effort, I think, is a way for us to shed light on the ways that brands can and should be working with autistic folks, which is why we launched at CAN, to say there's a whole pool of talent that you aren't even thinking about, or maybe that you've thought about, but you're not working with them in a way that is accessible. The reality is that we need more brands to sign on to using the images, to pledge to use the images, before this becomes a fully, you know, economically viable opportunity for people at scale. But I'm hopeful with some of the conversations that we're having that that will continue to progress. But I think in and of itself, this project will hopefully demonstrate the opportunity to big brands on investing in talent that represents their audiences, represents the people that they want to be speaking to, but also invests in talent that can be highly creative. I mean, as you mentioned, the images are beautiful, right? Like, why wouldn't you want to work with people who view the world a little bit differently and express themselves in a way that is extremely creative and use that in your brand content?
Absolutely. These are the questions that we need to ask. And I'm glad that the work that you're doing, and you know, to like, that's kind of my goal with what I do as well, is to provide a platform for people from many different kinds of walks of life and many different backgrounds to share their stories. And how I mentioned earlier, there's uniqueness, obviously, because we have different backgrounds, but we are all autistic, and it doesn't matter the level of autistic or whatnot. We are all autistic, and it's a spectrum. And I think that it's super important that we highlight just, you know, how much we've been misrepresented and left out of the conversation. And there are some pretty, you know, so you mentioned Google, you mentioned Hiki, and but there's also the UN Women's Unstereotype Alliance backing this initiative. And I kind of want to get into that as well, because that's major. What does their support mean for this project, and how does it align with their goals?
Yeah, so the Unstereotype Alliance is UN Women's commercial and advertising arm. So they were founded by UN Women at Cannes Lions, actually about 5 years, 5 or 6 years ago. And they were founded acknowledging that brands hold a lot of economic power and pledging to unstereotype their content, move the needle on representation to be more nuanced, be more intersectional, as well as hiring people from diverse backgrounds, not only like in front of the camera, but also in your agency, you know, the agencies that you work with, the creators that you work with, how you're spending your ad dollars to support women-owned media, Black-owned media, queer-owned media. The entire marketing ecosystem can have a lot of impact in reshaping society for good. And there wasn't a centralized industry body who was doing that across geographical lines, who is doing that, and the way that the Unstereotype Alliance does. So the Alliance seeks to remove stereotypes from advertising, media, and content. They have some of the biggest brands participating in it, from Unilever, Mars. I insert a brand, they are probably somehow involved with the Unstereotype Alliance. And obviously with the UN backing it, they not only talk about things, but they actually do things, and they do things in a very meaningful way. So I sat at a number of work streams with them, and I'm actively involved with UN Women and the Unstereotype Alliance, and having their backing behind this is, you know, at the most simple level, it's like the seal of approval that we have the UN Women's backing on what this project is doing. And I think on a more tangible level, it shows to brands who might want to work and use this type of content, that it has the Alliance's backing on what we're trying to do, which, you know, it goes a long way, especially in an industry that can be as layered and complex as media and advertising. So we were very grateful to have their support. They do incredible work. And, you know, me being a part of some of the work that they're doing, it was quite humbling to have the Alliance say, of course, we will support this.
I love that. And I didn't, to be completely transparent, I didn't even know that there was a UN Women's Unstereotype Alliance until I learned about this initiative. And so thank you for bringing that to the forefront too, because even as someone who does advocacy work from an intersectional lens, being like someone who sits at almost all of the intersections, not even knowing that that was a resource out there actively working to basically rewrite the face of autism or stereotypes in general in media is amazing. And that kind of brings me to another point that I wanted to ask, because this is, it seems like it's something that is still in its early stages, but is making a lot of headway. So how could individuals, if they wanted to be involved, help support this project and contribute to the mission of challenging stereotypes?
That's a great question. I think the first thing is share it, right? Like the more visibility that we get behind this, the better. It's been out since June and we've gotten a lot of press, a lot of interest, a lot of attention behind it. I think another way that people can just broadly challenge stereotypes is just show up in spaces, right? Like the reason why social media has been such a powerful tool for people with disabilities is because we're able to organize, find each other, see each other in a way that mainstream media just hasn't and has frankly, in a lot of ways, failed at showing up for the disabled community and the autistic community specifically. And I think by us showing up, regardless of all of that, is us actively resisting the ways that we've been ignored and spoken over. And I can say from, you know, the work that I do in my day job, leading inclusive innovation at an agency, brands are noticing this. Brands are paying attention and they're asking, what do we need to be doing to support these communities? What do we need to be doing to meet how culture is changing, to change our advertising, change our content, change even our products to be more accessible? So I think that in and of itself, although it feels like things aren't changing as fast as we want, you know, on the other side of what's happening in the worlds of like corporate America, people are paying attention and hopefully there will start to be some change, albeit somewhat slowly.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to go off on a tangent because I definitely could when it comes to my story and my experience with corporate America. I'm unfortunately one of those people who got chewed up and spit out after years of service with that. And a lot of it's related to autism. So I love that we've had a discussion about challenging stereotypes all around and also the importance of understanding like how not just media, but I feel like it can extend to any kind of industry, how they're just like not fishing from a very viable pool for reasons, you know, completely surrounding a fundamental lack of understanding truly what autism is, what autistic people can do, and how we can really be an asset to many organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you and I could definitely go on a tangent about that. Maybe we'll do a part two to this podcast. As somebody who's worked in corporate my entire adult life, I've been on sides of it where it's, you know, I was ready to leave. I was ready to quit. I was ready. I similar to you, feel like I was getting spit out. And it's only because I've had really good leaders who've seen my disability as part of my identity, part of my value that I've thrived, not just, you know, made it through, but I've been able to thrive. And the reality is that is extremely rare. And I talk to other autistic folks and it's like, that didn't happen for me. I never had that type of leader. And what needs to happen next in the broader context of corporate America is viewing neurodiversity, not just like as this trend to reposition your DE&I efforts around, but actually like making meaningful change for neuro-inclusive efforts.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm personally very passionate about and something that I'm cautiously optimistic that will hopefully change. But I think the reality is corporate America in a lot of ways is just not set up for autistic people, period, full stop. And it comes from a leadership that doesn't understand what neuro-inclusive leadership actually is.
Absolutely. I think since we opened that door, it kind of made me think of another question. I don't know. I kind of want to get your perspective on this. For me, hierarchy just doesn't make sense intrinsically, although I get it and I understand it, you know, being someone who's had to work in corporate America. But how do you think, and I don't want to speak about us autistic people as a monolith, but I do know that being egalitarian and just kind of treating people the same is kind of a through point or a common thread. How do you think that has an impact when it comes to us working in corporate America? And just to kind of preface that, I know that I got in trouble a lot because I didn't inherently see a hierarchy and I didn't know that I was supposed to act different ways with different people. I just treated everybody the same. And it got me kind of a reputation of being like arrogant, or I thought I was better than other people because I didn't know my place. So that's kind of why I'm asking the question of someone who's in leadership in a corporate setting, like how do you think that plays into that?
This is like a really, really challenging subject because for me, I look back at a lot of my career and I see a lot of those points of like, I was able to navigate it because I'm really good at masking. you know, and that is just the reality. And that's why, even though masking is so traumatizing, it is a privilege, right? Like I was able to mask and figure out a way to figure out, okay, I don't agree exactly with what they're saying and I want to say this, but I guess I'll just kind of figure out another way to articulate myself so I don't piss anybody off. And sometimes I did that and sometimes I didn't. And that's when I was not doing great in my career, because to your point, a lot of professional structures are built off of those hierarchies. I think I've been privileged enough to work with leaders who view more of like a flat leadership view and view things a little bit more egalitarian, which in some cases I think is somewhat reflective of changing tides of what leadership looks like. But honestly, I don't have an answer to that, because I've also worked with people who view things so vertically. And even as someone who's really good at masking, I've not been able to function in those types of teams at all. So for people who can't mask as well, what are you supposed to do? Right? Like it's at odds with how we just fundamentally think and operate. So it's one of those things that, as somebody who's been able to navigate the corporate world and find myself in a leadership position, you're absolutely right. There is a reality that there are structures to corporate America that are just antithetical to how autistic folks operate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to be a question that I'm going to have to keep mulling over, because I haven't yet found a real answer. I just know that I think it's because I'm unmasking, and I know that if I were to have to try to survive that again, I would have to purposely mask. But since when I was masking before, it was a trauma response and wasn't like purposeful, I can't put the mask back on. So I think that's where it's like the disconnect of trying to figure out how you can actually work in that structure. And maybe the answer is that the structure needs to truly fundamentally change, to your point that you said earlier about DE&I being actually inclusive of different neural types, as opposed to just being performative to check off the box of saying we're diverse and we care about, you know, April being Autism Awareness Month or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. The one thing I actually would add that I was just thinking about too is it's why self-advocacy is so important for autistic folks. And on the flip side, it's why leaders need to actually like listen when self-advocacy is happening. I know for me, something that I just like to ask people before I move into a formal engagement working with them, whether it's a new team member or working on a new project with a group of people, is how do you like to work best? Like, I know for me, I prefer to have less meetings, maybe a couple of meetings, and then we work over email. Some people don't like that. And sometimes there needs to be a little bit of compromise on what works best for people and finding ways to compromise and meet in the middle. And I think it's why companies need to create a culture where self-advocacy is celebrated and embraced rather than being viewed as like annoying. Because I know I was able to self-advocate, but as I've mentioned, you know, 4 or 5 times, that's not the norm. But what does a culture of self-advocacy look like? It looks like creating space to understand that not everyone works the same. You want the best work out of people. You need to maybe adjust how you're working. And sometimes maybe we need to adjust how we're working too, but not at odds with what our needs actually are. So it's complex, but it's why leaders need to listen before they start speaking, because self-advocacy is the most viable way to mitigate some of those issues.
Absolutely. I love that you brought up that, like, a lot of the time self-advocacy is seen as annoying, as opposed to just being like, hey, I want to work here. I want to keep doing this, but this is what I need in order to be able to do it. In my experience, it gets seen as you're trying to play the system, or you're trying to ask for special privileges, or you think you're special. That's what happened to me when I got a request, or I put in a request for an accommodation to work remotely. It was, why do you need this? You don't actually need this. What's the problem? And, you know, kind of, that's what I mean. I got chewed up and spit out the first time I asked for something that I really needed. So I'm glad that we kind of delved off into this conversation, because I feel like it's important to bring that up. But I did actually have another question for you related to what we were talking about earlier. You have a very unique position, like you said, being autistic, but also working in a leadership position in media. So what advice would you give to other potential leaders or potential advocates or people who want to do it, but have felt like they don't have the tools or the capacity or haven't seen someone like you successfully do it. What advice would you give to them if they to challenge those stereotypes and just go for their passions?
I would say that, and this is advice that I wish I could have given myself at the age of 23 when I wasn't doing so great 10 years ago. I would say that everything that you think is wrong with you is actually the thing that makes you most special and most interesting, and use that to your advantage. I know that I used to not get made fun of, maybe get made fun of, let's just call it what it is. I would get made fun of for being the person who would be like overly formal with how they speak and would seem like I'm scripting everything. And it's like, of course I am, because I'm like literally scripting before I go into a conversation with somebody. That I spend too much time in my head and I don't seem like collaborative enough and like brainstorms and things like that. And I've actually like flipped that whole narrative for myself to say, well, I'm an incredible public speaker. I'm a formal speaker, but I'm incredible at it. I spend a lot of time in my head because I'm constantly thinking and processing things. So I'm probably like unpacking things that some of my colleagues might not even be thinking about yet. And I collaborate, but I collaborate a little bit differently. Like I love one-on-ones. You know, I'm not shy or introverted if I'm in a one-on-one setting. Throw me in a group of 20 people and I'm like, I don't even know. I can't talk. This is not going to happen. And I think we don't do a great job in professional contexts at seeing the individual individuality of neurodivergent people, of autistic people, of disabled people. We are very good at seeing like the individuality and the creativity coming from like the biggest, shiniest personalities in a room, like extroverts who are very good at socializing and working a room. So I hope and I want to encourage to other people to see that because you don't fit the mold doesn't mean that you aren't fitting your mold. Like your mold is what makes you so special. It's just about identifying what are you really good at that actually people undervalue and underappreciate, and use that to your advantage. And then building on that is building a personal brand will like quite literally change your life. Very early in my career, one of my mentors, who I owe a lot to, he told me, build your personal brand in a way that celebrates all the things that you're good at, and use that in everything that you do. Market the hell out of it. You know, for me, it's all about using media and technology for social good. Early in my career, everything that I was doing, I would like market that to people who might see that and understand, oh, Rachel's really good at this. Let's bring her into this project, right? Or if you don't work in a corporate environment, you're trying to be a social media creator, building your personal brand will be everything, because that's what your audience will know you for. So very long-winded way to say, everything that you're being challenged about and you think is a flaw for you is probably really what just makes you special and what you need to market the hell out of and make your personal brand that is unique and ownable to you. The most successful people in the world, name anybody, that's exactly what they're doing.
I love that. That's such salient advice, especially since a lot of us, especially if we grew up undiagnosed, we're just made to feel like everything about our authentic expression was wrong. We have behavioral issues or you're weird. And there's a lot of internalized shame and internalized ableism that comes along with it. So I think that is such salient advice to start by embracing everything about yourself that was made to feel wrong or made to feel like is, you know, unacceptable, because yeah, that's how you'll be remembered. You'll be remembered for being you, not by squashing yourself into the same box that unfortunately so many other people are already trying to fit into.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that. And like you mentioned the word shame, and I think shame is a feeling and an emotion that is so pervasive in the autistic community, because I know for me, before I was diagnosed, I struggled the most with feeling ashamed about just even getting up and speaking in a room or posting something on social media. I would just feel shame and I didn't know why. And now in hindsight, I know it's because one, I was masking, so I wasn't being my authentic self, and that felt particularly shameful. And two, I was constantly being told that X, Y, and Z I was doing was weird or off-putting, or insert any other type of negative feedback. And that felt shameful. So moving beyond shame means just embracing who you are and like not giving a shit about what people have to say about it, because the people who see your value, see your sparkle, see what makes you special. Like, those are the important people. And it sounds really reductive and maybe kind of corny, but truly and honestly, that is the best advice that I could give anybody in this space.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have to. I think that it's a common thread that we kind of develop people pleasing as a consequence of masking, which then makes us diminish ourselves. I know for me, like, it took me forever to start to dress the way that I wanted to dress. Like, you know, just because I didn't want to call attention to myself, because every time I did something that called attention to myself, it was received negatively. So just being able to embrace that and be like, oh, well, like, if you don't like what I'm doing, that just means you don't resonate with me. It doesn't mean that I'm wrong. It just means that we're not meant to be, you know, in community or whatever. It does, you know, you're okay over there, I'm okay over here. I don't have to fit myself in the box that you've agreed works for you.
Exactly. And it's like, especially the case for women, femmes, and other people who've been socialized as female, like, intersect it with that. And it's like, we automatically assume that we are in the wrong if people are perceiving us in a negative way, and that we need to fix ourselves. It's, the whole thing is such a mind meld that requires so much unlearning, that I would be lying if I said I'm not still unlearning. I still every day have to course correct myself, but it's liberating when you are able to move past it and be like, no, I'm not the issue, right? Like, of course there are times where we need to help be held accountable, but a lot of times we're not the issue. It's just people have different opinions about us, and that's fine.
Absolutely. Or like, one thing that I get a lot is my direct communication. So this, I was thinking about when you were talking about how you were able to mask and kind of word things a little bit differently, and that helped you get by. I realized that that's probably one of the reasons why I wasn't able to navigate that as well, because I don't have as much nuance sometimes. Like, I just speak directly. And then me being a woman, and being a Black woman, if I speak directly, I'm going to be received as aggressive, or be like, and it's just like, yeah, so I don't know. I think the reason why that just popped in my head was just like thinking about intersectionality and being a woman, and just how we have to diminish ourselves in those ways. And then you add being autistic and having a direct communication style and having flat affect and not raising my voice and not being so sweet. It's just like, I really am so excited about the work that we're doing, because, like, I don't think people realize how exhausting it is to exist as a autistic person with other multiple intersections. It's exhausting trying to fit into a world that has never really tried to understand us, much less accommodate us.
I mean, everything that you just said, I'm just like nodding my head ferociously because, I mean, I could talk about this for hours. You being direct is going to be perceived very differently than me being direct, right? Like, it just is, between being a white woman and a Black woman. And that, to me, is what needs to happen next in when we're talking about neuro-inclusive workspaces or neuro-inclusive culture. I think we do a really good job at like laying out what the general issues are, but what needs to happen next is the intersections of how those personality traits, how those approaches to, or how those autistic identities are perceived differently. And I think that hasn't been so central to the conversation, and it needs to be, because as we were talking about all the way up in the beginning, if it's not intersectional, it's not representative. And it's, you know, the complexities of all of your identities are going to reflect very differently. What's that quote? It's like, this stupidest people in the world are the happiest people in the world. And I feel like autistic people are so self-aware about a lot of the way our identities are perceived, that it just causes this internal trauma when we realize, oh, I'm going to say something that's not going to be perceived well. You know, me as a woman, you as a Black woman, and there's going to be like 10 times more impact with that. It causes this like internal trauma that we can't get out of our heads because of it. Right. Mm-hmm. Even if we want to move past and think, I don't care what people think, there is going to be a reality where sometimes you have to care what people think, or that you have to navigate a complex situation that we're just not equipped to navigate. And to overcome that, that's why neuroinclusivity needs to be intersectional.
Absolutely. And just to add to that, I think communication styles need to be at the forefront of how we understand the differences between holistic and autistic people, because I feel like that is the biggest hurdle. Because so much of what we say or don't say gets interpreted, like gets projected upon. Like, so if you say something directly, it gets interpreted as being aggressive. Or if you're quiet and you don't speak, it's like you're standoffish. And it's like,
none of those things could be true. Maybe both of those things, maybe one of those things, you wouldn't know if you don't understand how to approach it or see like that these other intersections impact how this person communicates.
Absolutely. And I think actually that goes back to a point that I was making earlier about asking how people like to work. Another thing that I would say is that it's okay to say to people, this is how I like to work best. I communicate very directly. And sometimes I might not say anything at all, but I promise you, you will always get honesty from me. And even just saying that to somebody, I feel like level sets with non-autistic folks of like, as a reminder, here's how I communicate. It might be a little bit differently and you need to hold their hands a little bit. Mm-hmm. And for I found at least with a lot of the non-autistic people that I work with, that I'm friends with, that's actually improved our relationships quite a bit. It won't work in all scenarios, but I think at the beginning of any work or professional engagement, like it's okay to say that and it will probably go a long way with that person. On the flip side, they need to do it back to you too. They need to express, here's how I communicate. Here's what you're going to get from me. Because like, as we know, they won't always be direct or honest. And sometimes we'll have to like pull things out of them because we can't read between the lines. And I think that, you know, just more open communication can help all of us.
Absolutely. When you brought that up, I like chuckled a little because I'm like, it's the reading between the lines or the insinuating, the like making a statement, but you're supposed to know that the statement was actually an implied request. That killed me all the time. I'm just like, I didn't know that I was supposed to do this. I thought you were just making a statement.
Honestly, that's when I've gotten in trouble most at work is when that's when it was like, you should have been reading between the lines. It's like, there was lines, no one told me there was lines in this conversation. But things have improved for me when I've started to say, I can't read between the lines. What are you trying to tell me? Just hit me with the facts.
Yes. It's so funny. When you brought that up, I just started my own little line of merch called the Girl Spicy Bodega. And one of the shirts.
I love it. It's so cute. It's so cute.
Thank you so much. I'm really proud of it. I've been working on it for a while, so I was excited to get it launched. And one of the designs is if you didn't say it, I didn't hear it. And because that's one of my models now. Once I started to unpack like why I was having so many miscommunications with people, especially autistic people, I was like, it's because they didn't say what they meant. And so if you didn't say it, I didn't hear it. I heard what you said, but I'm not hearing the implications behind it. And so I don't know. I think like that is so important that people say that up front, because I'll admit I didn't know to advocate for myself that way, to set that expectation. So if people don't know that that's my best way, they're going to interpret my actions that way. But going forward, I do say that I'm like, look, if you didn't say it, I didn't hear it. I'm not going to read between the lines. And if you want me to know something, you're going to have to tell me.
Honestly, I'm going to tattoo that on my body because it's so accurate. And I need that shirt, but I'm also going to tattoo it on my body.
Awesome. Well, yes. If you get it, girl, I want to see you rocking it.
I'm going to post all about it. Don't you worry.
I love it. Well, before we go, I just wanted to know what's next for you personally and what future initiatives can we expect from you in the realm of inclusive innovation?
Yeah, I have a lot of stuff coming up for next year, both with my work with Mindshare and stuff that I do on my own through my social media platform and other things like that. You know, I can't go into specifics, but broadly speaking, my big focus for the next 12 months is to continue to beat the drum of brands hold a lot of money, that money can be used to reshape society for good, because unfortunately the public sector is failing us right now in that regard. And while the private sector can't fix all of these issues, there's a lot of things that they can do better and improve on, from supporting and funding disabled creators, supporting and funding diverse owned media, and, you know, in some cases, figuring out how we detoxify the social media ecosystem to be safer and more inclusive for people who've been marginalized by it. And then the other stuff that I'm focusing on is in the world of neuro-inclusive leadership and how we talk about neurodiversity in the workplace to actually be meaningful and impactful. So I can't go into specifics there, but all that being said, I'm hopeful and slightly optimistic that there will be some slow and steady progress in the media industry over the next couple of years. And hopefully I'll be able to be a part of some of those conversations and solutions.
And that was Rachel Lowenstein. If you enjoyed that interview, I highly suggest you go over and follow her on LinkedIn, but especially follow her on TikTok. It's your big sister's autistic diary over there, and she gives great advice. I love her style and her perspective. Definitely appreciate her time and her experience and her sharing about this project. I'm super, super excited about the partnership with Getty Images and having more authentic representation in the autistic space. So again, all the links where you can find Rachel and her work and the article that we discussed will be in the description wherever you're listening to this show. So this week on TikTok Therapy, I stumbled upon this video. We're not mutuals, but this resulted in an instant follow. Her username is Emily Enjoys. And after this video, we're going to come back and expand upon it.
People are like, oh, you make me uncomfortable because you're quiet. Oh, you make me uncomfortable because you have to leave the party early to have some alone time to recharge. I'm like, you make me uncomfortable because you're a pathological liar. You make me uncomfortable because I can't trust anything that comes out of your mouth. You make me uncomfortable because you have an issue with communication. You make me uncomfortable because you bully people for the way that they are, and you want them to change who they are just so that you don't have to change your worldview and you don't have to be just slightly more accepting of other people's differences. I feel like autistic people are always told how we can fit in better, how we can better communicate with other people, and it's like, have you ever thought about the fact that we're always having to do the work and nobody else does? We're just taking abuse from other people. Especially when you go undiagnosed your entire life and you're forced to fit into this mold of what a person should be. Otherwise, people just ruin your life on a daily basis. And then you find out, oh my God, I'm autistic. I really can't change who I am. And I've been just feeling guilty about being a human being for my entire life. And there's nothing that I can do. Meanwhile, my life is so difficult because I have to navigate it with people who lie, who do bad things, who take advantage of me. And then they tell me that I'm the one with the problem. It's like, no, I was born this way. This is who I am. I think you could be a little bit nicer.
Spot on. No notes. I just wanted to expand upon this because this is a very accurate view of an autistic person's view of the world. It's like, whether you're diagnosed in youth or you are late diagnosed, you've probably experienced something similar where natural expressions of who you are get disciplined out of you, get ridiculed out of you. And I want to talk about shoulding all over yourself. I actually had a former coworker who phrased it this way, and ever since I was just like, yes, that's exactly what it is. We should all over ourselves. We internalize the external pressures and expectations of other people, and then we place it on ourselves, right? And we feel like we can never reach the mark. And that's true. It reminds me of that scene in Endgame where Thor goes back in time and he gets to see his mom and he's explaining what happened. And she's like, you know, You're just like everybody else. You may have failed. And he's like, well, I'm not supposed to be like everybody else. And she's like, well, everyone fails at being who they're supposed to be. But the true measure of a man is how successful they are at being who they are, not who they're supposed to be. And again, that's a paraphrase. But I bring that up because this is a lesson that we do not actually like teach each other or learn in society. We just continue to allow other people's expectations to dictate what we do in our lives. And when we come across people who don't, who are the rarity, they get ridiculed. They get called crazy. They get called, you know, on the fringes. They need to be locked up. They need to be in a mental facility, blah, 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 blah. Because to you, it's crazy to diverge from this script. But in reality, the people who decide to be authentically themselves, whether it's on script or not, are the ones who are actually free. And people don't realize that they keep themselves in a chokehold and then they police other people's behavior because if I can't be myself, how dare you be yourself? And again, I don't believe that people are doing this consciously. I believe that it's a subconscious thing. They don't realize that because they've internalized that this is how they're supposed to be. And the closer you are to the mark, the more you feel like you've made it. So the less likely you're going to be cognizant of the mechanisms behind your actions. But even if you become the president and CEO of a big company and you have this title and you get all this respect, at the end of the day, you're still going to police other people's behavior, because if some little peon who's lower on the totem pole than you has the audacity to do what they want because it's intrinsically good to them, or it feels intrinsically good to them, and you spent your entire life suppressing who you are to get this arbitrary title that was given to you by someone else, and you see that they're happy, that you're going to take that as a threat. You're going to be confused. You're like, how is it that this person who has less than me in this system has the audacity to have confidence in themselves and speak to me like I'm an equal? And it's because this person's worth is not measured by how they compare to other people. Their worth is intrinsic. And we don't teach people to have intrinsic value in our society, in this culture. It is fully drilled into us that your worth is tied to your position in the hierarchy. And because of that, that's why so many people internalize shame, internalize guilt and fear based off of how they diverge from this prescripted, you know, predetermined way that they're supposed to be. So anyway, how does this relate to the video? Well, the reason why I bring that up is because the video really highlights how this mentality of the shoulds really, really impacts autistic people. It impacts everyone, but it super impacts autistic people, because think about it like this. If you are holistic and you already are able to pick up on the social cues and you learn them through osmosis the way, you know, that it is taught, because no one says the quiet part out loud. These are all learning how to speak passively, learning how to do things with social cues. They're just learned through osmosis. No one sits down and tells you these rules explicitly, right? So even if you are someone who is holistic, you still to some degree are masking, you're hiding parts of who you truly are in order to fit in based off of the system. If you are a cishet white male, you probably have internalized that you're supposed to get married, you're supposed to have kids, you're supposed to have a house, a car, and a dog. And even if those things don't actually seem appealing to you, even if you would rather be a nomad who like traveled the world and, you know, didn't have any roots, like because of your position in society as a cishet white male, you internalize that I should do this. I should have a respectable job. I should have a wife. I should have kids. I should have a house and a car. And it doesn't really, you don't really give yourself the permission to be your true self. So that's already happening for people who are quote unquote winning, who are holistic, who are able to climb themselves up within this hierarchy. Imagine how much more that affects someone who is autistic, who may not pick up on those social cues. So not only are they on the fringes because they were in a society where very few people actually do hit that mark, but then now they have an additional barrier of not being able to communicate the same way as somebody else, not understanding the social rules the same way as somebody else, maybe having some idiosyncrasies about themselves. Maybe they have echolalia. Maybe they like to have a vocal stem. Maybe they stem with little fidget toys. Maybe they have trouble making eye contact. All these other small things that impact autistic people that are interpreted through an holistic and a neurotypical lens as being negative just add on to the pressure to mask in this kind of society. And this is why so many autistic people, especially late diagnosed autistic people, suffer from depression, suffer from anxiety, have a high rate of suicide. Because if you are constantly conditioned to believe that who you are is just not good, it's not good enough, you're never going to hit the mark. After hearing that for 20, 30 years and living in a society that will chew you up and spit you out, it is no real like stretch of the imagination to understand why so many autistic people end up, you know, alone, depressed, suicidal, and really pushed to the fringes of society, because nothing we do is good enough in this society And that's amplified more than what is already placed on autistic people. And so one of my goals with deconstructing neurodivergence isn't just to understand neurodivergence better and neurodivergence in our relation to broader society, but it's to also highlight the patterns in neurotypical and autistic behavior that are detrimental to you as well. And I think this is one of them, having this should mentality, internalizing the expectations and the pressures of wider society to the point that you completely abandon who you are. And in doing so, you adopt this ideology and this philosophy that if you have to do this, then everyone else has to do this. So I'm going to go ahead and police other people's behavior by either making consequences for them or trying to make them feel ashamed or afraid or guilty about being an individual. And it just creates this cycle that is so toxic. And when you point it out, when you say the quiet part out loud, then people are like, oh, you just want permission to be weird. Yeah, actually, I do. I've given myself that permission, but it would be nice that if I, you know, go out and interact with society like we ultimately have to do, that I won't then get pushed back into my shell because I dared to leave my home being unapologetically myself. So that's just my little two cents, and I'm really grateful for this video. Again, their username is Emily and Joyce. I'm going to be leaving their link in the description as well. But yeah, that I really wanted to expand upon that. We need to stop shitting all over ourselves and really listen to what feels intrinsically good to us. We have one life. There are no do-overs. We don't get to do this a second time, you guys. So if this is the only time that we're going to be able to do this, live this life in this incarnation with these memories, with this mind, why are we wasting it living for other people? Because that's what you're doing when you continue to shit all over yourself. You're shaping your life so that other people will see you in a certain way. Other people will be proud of you. Other people will be jealous of you. Other people may see you as aspirational, whatever. But if your guidepost for how you live your life is how other people are going to see you, that already to me is the biggest red flag that you are not living for yourself. You're shitting all over yourself. You're not being authentic. And you really need to dig deep and figure out who you are and start living that truth as soon as you can. I want to thank you guys once again for stopping by and spending a little bit of time with me today. As always, I appreciate you. Make sure you come back for the next episode of Beyond Deconstructing Neurodivergence. And in the meantime, if you want to support your girl, make sure you head over to the Neural Spicy Bodega. Pick up your gear today. There's going to be a few sales coming up as the holiday season rolls around. So make sure you check that out. And make sure you post and tag me on Instagram when you do get your gear. I want to see you guys looking fly, looking cool. Also, I'm super excited to continue working on the Neural Spicy Dictionary. Pre-orders will not be opening until January because I want to actually be able to give you guys a preview for those of you guys who support me through pre-ordering. So I pushed it back to make sure that I do have the time to devote to it that it really deserves, especially for you guys who are willing to support me ahead of time. So all that can be found on my website, tjamaicapulp.com. And as always, stay safe. I love you guys, and I'll catch you guys back here next time.